Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with Miriam O'Callaghan.
My guests this morning are a husband and wife. If Alice had taken her father's advice, she might have been a ban garda in County Tipperary. If Dermot had followed in his family's footsteps, he might have worked at the Harland & Wolff shipyard in Belfast. But both decided instead to become artists. Dermot Seymour is a painter whose work has been described as upfront, compelling and stark. It's also often very funny. Alice Marr's midlife retrospective is currently running at the Irish Museum of Modern Art at Earlsford Terrace here in Dublin until February 2013. It is called Becoming and has been described by critics as the most impressive retrospective by an Irish artist mounted in this country in years. You're both very welcome.
Thank you.
Where did you meet, given you're in different ends of the country nearly?
We met in Belfast, I guess, didn't we?
Yeah, I think the first time I think I seen you was walking up one of those avenues that connect the Malone Road with the Lisburn Road. And I just remarked to myself about the, what would you call it, the
attractiveness of her?
Well, the kind of more than that, the kind of... like the racehorseness of her. And anyway, I just left it at that because I was already in company in a private house and we were talking about something else.
What did you mean by the racehorseness of her?
Elegance, that's the exact word I'm looking for.
Yeah.
But I was then we probably met for the first time actually in the Crown Bar, which is where most people met.
Yeah. Yeah.
In kind of central Belfast.
Yeah. I was opposite a student. Europa there.
Yeah. Yeah. I was doing my master's degree in Belfast, and Dermot was already an artist out working, but we all used to mill around and mix around together like that. So I'd say that's the first time I saw you, probably the Crown.
Yeah, that's what I was going to kind of say, that the next time, I think it was a week later, I met her in the Crown Bar, where we'd always go on Fridays, and she was the new ones on the block from the south.
So were you very pleased to see her there, since you'd spotted her elegance a week before?
Well, yes, because she was exotic and new. We always liked to flirt with the southerners that would come up occasionally to do the MA course.
So it was a very small MA group. You know, there were only about six or seven people on it, so it was very intense. And we had a wonderful teacher called Alistair McLennan. But we all, you know, used to hang around together. And so we would meet all the artists who were working in Belfast at the time. It was a whole group that milled and mixed together and partied together. And, you know, like Belfast at the time was quite, I suppose, a dangerous place to be, you know. But there was a great party scene as well underneath the radar. You know, the town used to close down at night completely and it would be shut up. But still, we were out there looking for fun and looking for conversations.
About
late 80s. Yeah. So he was hanging around the town painting.
Yeah.
But he was a crazy looking guy. You know,
paint a picture.
Yes, paint a picture. Well, he was dressed mostly all in black with a long black coat. He had the long black hair, the moustache, the black eyes. And he also had a black dog that used to go around with him as well.
But did you like him from the beginning?
I did. I did like him from the beginning, yeah. It was just something about Dermot. He was just truly himself always. He was never pretending to be anybody else, or he couldn't be like that. He was a true individual. So right from the beginning, I think I liked him, and I think we were kind of mates right from the beginning.
And you, Dermot?
Oh, yeah. And this is where the trip to the Cork Jazz Festival.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. Oh, yeah.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, you see, I was walking the dog. He was a sheepdog. He wasn't totally black.
What was the name of the dog?
Murphy. And I think it was coming out of the Botanic Gardens, and there's this van pulled up with all these lulas on it. And, of course, it was Alice.
It was my class, you know, my MA class. It was very interesting times, you know, at the time in Ireland, like the church was holding sway down here, the war was going on up there, and then suddenly these statues started moving, you know, the statues of the Virgin Mary were moving.
Yeah.
And Rita Duffy, you know, said, we have to go and see this moving statue. So she got hold of the Students' Union van. Imagine the Students' Union had a van at the time, and she was able to get hold of that, and we all piled into the van and we were going to drive to Ballinsfeddle. But when we were passing, I saw Dermot walking the dog, and Rita just pulled in, and I opened the back door, you know, said, do you want to come to Cork? So he just piled in with the dog into the back of the van, and off we went on the Odyssey, you know, down through the country, right down
through the Midlands.
Yeah.
Belfast to Cork, that's a long drive for Rita to make.
Yeah. Well, we broke up we stopped the journey in Tipperary. So Dermot actually met my mother and father, even though they've passed away now, but he met them
then,
years and years ago.
Yeah.
And we went to see the statue. We arrived really, really late, remember?
Yeah.
And it was dark. And so we got out at the van and we were looking up at the statue and it had this kind of crown of lights, you know, around it.
I know, it.
And the next thing, I was looking at it and Dermot said to me, "It's moving."
Well, it was moving. It definitely moved. I seen it myself. I was never brought up in Marian cult worship or anything like that. No reference to yourself. But anyway, I think you know what I mean.
Yeah, and there was a nun beside me kneeling down, kind of reverent, and she said, "What happened? What happened? What did you see? What did
you see?" Are you saying it really did
move? It definitely moved. Now, how it moved,
well, it was
I
an
do
optical
not
illusion,
know.
You know. Yeah.
But how it moved, I don't know.
It was the lights, Dermot.
Could have been anything.
Yeah.
And it wasn't mass hysteria because it was only us and a nun. So
it was the lights, man. You know, there was like lights around her head, and if you stare long enough at lights, the object beside them will start to move. That's what it was.
Well, I don't know about that because I was not staring at it. It's just every time I looked around, it was rocking, like really seriously rocking. And then it would tick away deliberately to make sure that it wasn't the lights. And I'd look back and it was really rocking, really, really rocking. So for me, it definitely moved.
People talk about it being a religious experience. Was it for you?
I just thought it was brilliant. It was like
drama.
Drama. Theatre. It was an absurdity. In the real, I thought it was a fantastic experience. I wouldn't call it religious, but it certainly was an experience.
But you didn't get romantically entangled at that stage of your life.
No.
Why
not? Yeah, yeah. Well, we were always with other people, actually. You know, he always had really nice girlfriends and I would have had kind of boyfriends, serial boyfriends and stuff. So it just never seemed to come into the equation. And I just didn't think of him like that. Either. I don't know why.
Just circumstances, you know, and it wasn't very long after that I would find myself leaving anyway. Mm. First of all, I came down to Dublin or Dunleary, teaching at Dunleary College of Art, and then ended up in New York on a fellowship thing. So I was there for a while.
And I was in San Francisco at the same time. Yeah. Funnily enough, I was on a scholarship to San Francisco Art Institute. And at the same time, Dermot was living in New York and he sent me a postcard. It's funny, like the way we just kept connecting over the years on different levels. But he sent me this postcard, a picture of Madonna. And at that time, she was the big thing. So anyway, he told me in the postcard that he had snogged Madonna in a queue waiting to go into an exhibition in New York. So I don't know if that's true or not.
Well, it is true, yeah.
It is true.
Yeah.
But anyone could have told you they were Madonna.
Well, no, and she was with that other one that she hung around with at the time.
What?
Sarah Barnhart or whatever. Or not.
Oh, yes.
Whatever, do you remember? What?
Yeah, that's right, the comedian.
Well, anyway, but she just took a look at me and I took a look at her and then she asked me something and I said back with that funny Northern Irish accent, but that really sends them wild. And next thing, she just snogged me. And then she just went away off up the line somewhere. It was in the White Columns for some kind of group show in New York in 1987.
Is that a true story?
Yeah. No,
right.
Yeah.
Well, I only have a postcard to prove it, so.
But when you did get back together, it was much, much later on. Was it 20 years later? Like, when did you finally get together and how did you get together?
Oh, well, then you'd have to jump over the years a good bit.
How many years?
I guess we were already in our 40s then.
I think we were both invited to an exhibition in Poland, in Warsaw.
That's right, yeah.
And
it was called Fauna. And we were the only two artists who could go for some reason. There were a number of Irish artists in it.
Yeah.
And we were the only two who could travel. So we happened to go on the same plane. And we had a great time there.
What happened was when we got back, Alice invited me up. No, she didn't. I was actually in a show. And I actually contacted Alice to say, could I stay in her place?
That's right, yeah.
For this opening.
I was living in Dublin at the time.
That's right.
Yeah.
So we actually stayed.
Yeah. So then that started this kind of string of Dermot staying in my place when he was passing through Dublin.
Yeah.
So that's how we started to
get
close again.
Yeah.
People often say if you've had a friendship for years, a deep friendship, is it strange then when you become lovers? Is it different?
Yeah, I think Dermot put the idea into my head actually himself. We were climbing Kirkpatrick. He was living in Mayo at the time. You know, he'd live in this hovel over there and invited me over. And so we'll climb Kirkpatrick. So we're climbing Kirkpatrick. And we were actually talking about our various different partners. And, you know, both of us were free at the time and had just split up. And I was saying, well, Dermot, you know, sometimes there just isn't the person out there for you. You know, some people are meant to be single. Maybe that's me. Maybe the man isn't out there for me. And he was walking behind me. You know, I was climbing in front. And he said, I could be that man. And I stopped walking. You know,
it's very
romantic,
Dermot.
What did he just say? And he passed out and kept climbing, you know. So he was willing to admit that he'd said that, or else maybe he didn't even know he said that.
It's like something I would say, but in a kind of half Like, you know, nothing to kind of get down on my knees and marry me on the moment.
Do you remember saying that?
I'm not sure. I can't remember. But it wouldn't put it past me, yeah.
But I think that was the seed for me. That just put the thought in my mind, I think, because I had never thought about that before.
How did you come around to thinking of getting married? And why did you bother getting married?
I don't know. But sure, if you knew, you wouldn't.
Yeah. But Dermot has the notion of when he proposed to me that I can't remember at all.
Yeah, well, it was the Millennium Candle time. No, and we all got free candles.
Yeah.
And it was that particular New Year's
Eve, wasn't it?
Eve, and they were lighting them all at the foot of Croagh-Patrick for something. Yeah. So anyway, we had a party to go to up in Sligo on Loch Arrow. So we lit our candles at the foot of Croagh-Patrick and did all the EBGB stuff down there. And then we went on the road up to Sligo. And we were a bit early for Nick's thing. So we went down to Loch Arrow in a moonlight night. It was very cold. There was ice and frost was beginning to form, I think. And I know we had champagne with us and stuff. So I think that's where I think, and I'm almost certain, in fact, I'm definitely certain, that I, in some moment, talking about mayflies or something on how good Loch Arrow can
well,
be.
Well, I don't remember that.
I just sort of said to her, like, why don't me and you get married and have a glass of champagne here?
How romantic. I don't remember that at all. I just remember having the champagne, but I don't remember any words like that. I thought you asked me to marry you when we came back from dinner with Mary and John one night in Clanliff Road, but anyway, maybe I'm making that up.
No, maybe he asked you twice.
Maybe he asked me more than twice, yeah.
Yeah. And was it different to get married later in life?
Well, I don't know because I was never married before. So I can't compare it, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't think we expected to be married, you know. Yeah. Didn't really expect to be married or to, especially to marry each other. So it was really quite a celebration for us to kind of discover this in a way. And I remember when we were kind of planning it then, I thought, well, we'll get married in the registry office and we'll have a party in the house, you know, where I was in the North Strand. And Dermot said, no way are we getting married at the registry office. We're having a big, huge, you know, party.
Good for you, Dermot.
So that's where we got the big idea then, to have it in Tipperary, just, in a church. Yeah. He wanted to
I
have
didn't
a church.
Want any of this registry lark.
No. That's so interesting. And why did you want to have it in a church?
I love the atmospheres of churches, no matter what religion they are. I mean, even I would marry myself in a mosque when I wouldn't be allowed to. But as long as there was some kind of what is a church thing, you know.
Well, kind of beauty and ritual and, you know, so we're both kind of interested in ritual and we managed to get together a kind of Protestant Catholic ceremony where we had the local priest who was called Father Dwyer and then we had the Reverend Barbara Friday, the beautifully named Reverend Barbara Friday from the Church of Ireland. And that was really great.
What did you wear, to ask a really irrelevant but interesting question?
Well, I wore a dress that was made. I had a dress made by a wonderful dressmaker in Dublin called Denise Assaz. And she made this dress in the kind of medieval style, you know, with the long...
Describe it.
Long waist. Oh, well, it's a very long waist and a long train with kind of stand-up collar.
Colour?
It was gold. Gold. The dress was gold and the train was peacock blue.
Yeah. And what did you wear, Dermot?
A suit.
Clothes. As he said, for men.
Yeah, clothes.
So, yeah, it was a really fun wedding. And we had a big kind of marquee on my sister's farm, Christine, and her husband, Nicholas. They gave us a field. And all our friends from the past, you know, all these exes and, you know, friends from Belfast, friends from all over.
Just before that now, when we're still back in the church, my head here at the minute. But anyway, when you come up the aisle in that lark, when I looked around and seen you, like, I didn't know what way you were going to turn out. But anyway, she looked like Eleanor of Aquitaine.
Yeah.
On her betrothal to Louis the whatever. That's what it was like, even though it was in a little church in Kilmoiler in County Tipperary. Yeah. It looked like the cathedral in Rheims.
When you turned around and saw her like that, how did that make you feel?
Fab. The king had got our queen, you know, kind of thing.
Has it changed you being married to Dermot?
Yeah, I think it was very important for us to get married and to make that kind of public, you know, public statement, because we came to it as two complete individuals with two of their own, you know, their own lives and their own careers as artists and everything set up already. So to come together and make that public statement was really important. And I really like being married, and even though we don't share everything, you know, and it's not that kind of stuff you hear people talking about, soulmates and, you know, that kind of thing. It's more like two very individual people who come together where it works, you know, for them.
But when you say you don't share everything, like, yeah, what would you not share in your life?
Well, our work is very separate. We don't share, we don't advise each other or even comment really on each other's work.
But you'd be well aware, I'd be very much well aware of, yeah, Alice's process, and that's quite an honour and a privilege to see how it all comes about.
Yeah. And we're actually going to talk at length about your work in a little while, but we're going to bring in the first piece of music, which is Johnny Cash and June Carter. Just before we call it in, that moment where she looked like Eleanor of Aquitaine walking up the church,
yeah.
Do you think of that moment ever since then?
Yeah. All the time, because loads of times she still looks like Eleanor, yeah, of Aquitaine walking around the place in one way or another.
Oh, he's mad about you, which is lovely, Alice. But tell me about the first piece of music you both chose.
He's only telling you that.
Which is the Johnny Cash, June Carter.
Yes.
Tell me about it, why you both like it.
I had always wanted us to learn a song because, you know, we did a lot of partying, and you go to a party and you'd have your meal. The next thing is you're listening to music. The next thing is everyone starts singing. And we never seemed to have a song that, yeah, we could sing together. And I used to always say to Dermot, let's learn, you know, we got married in a fever, but we just never managed to do it.
You can still do it, you know, you can still learn.
We got married in a fever, hotter than a pepper sprout. We've been talking about Jackson ever since the fire went out. I'm going to Jackson, I'm gonna mess around. Yeah, I'm going to Jackson.
Johnny Cash and June Carter there with Jackson. Or we got married in a fever. You better both learn it now, cause, and then you can sing it. But look, you came from different parts of the country. You, Tipperary, Alice. Yeah. Tell me about your background.
South Tipperary. I'm from Kilmoyler, one of these conjoined parishes, Kilmoyler and Banshee. So I grew up, you know, on a small farm, I suppose, and had the usual rural childhood. Spent a lot of time wandering around on my own, looking at things and, you know, exploring the countryside. My mother loved beautiful things, and everything she did kind of beautifully. You know, even when she decorated a cake, or how she laid the table, or her garden, the way she organised it, was always beautiful and aesthetic, you know. So I think I kind of got that sense of beauty or aesthetic from her. The nuns actually did encourage us to be interested in art, but they didn't think art was a viable career, shall we say. But nobody did, you know, at that time. And I'd never met an artist, so I didn't really know what they did, you know, or how they made a living. So I went to study European studies. So I kind of studied Europe, so to speak.
Yeah. Did you like that?
I did. But I was a useless student, you know. I was having too much fun, really, being away from home and just being a student and going mad. But I think I did learn a lot in terms of reading, you know, how to read, how to research. And I liked it. And I liked writing. Now, I wasn't a great student. I didn't get a great degree. But I think I got quite a good education, actually.
And how did you think then of going into art? How did you make that transition?
Yeah, it was a transition. I used to do art at night, you know, so I'd go to night classes. Even when I was in Limerick going to college, I went to night classes there. And then I'd moved to Cork, and I was working there, actually working for a paint firm called HGW. And I worked for the advertising manager there. I was kind of his personal assistant. But I used to spend most of the time drawing on the sly, you know, in a drawer. And so when he'd come in, Mr. Farrer, I'd close the drawer like that, because I'd be preparing for my class that night in college. So little by little, what I was doing at night seemed to just get bigger and bigger in my consciousness. And so the nighttime just took over from the daytime. So I went into the art college. The first person I met was actually the director of the college, Mr. Maloney, at the time.
And which art college was it?
Crawford College in Cork. And I had this portfolio of really bad drawings, you know, that I'd done in night class, pastel drawings or something. And so he said, oh, what are you doing here? And I said, I'd like to go to arts college. So he brought me into the office and he looked at the drawings, and they were crap, like. But he must have seen something in me, you know, or else, you know, there was a place had come up, someone had refused a place or something. And he said, do you think you'd be able to start in 2 weeks' time? So I said I would. So
he obviously
just gave
spotted
up the
your
job.
Talent there
well,
and then.
Well, he certainly gave me a chance anyway. He did. Oh, and so from the first day, from the very first day that I walked in that door, I don't think I ever looked back. I just knew this is it now. And I worked really, really hard. And I'm still working hard.
Well, you know, life is so strange. It was great you met the director of that art college. And maybe if you hadn't met it, or if he'd rejected you, who's to know what might have happened?
Yeah, well, they're the happy accidents.
Yeah. Your background, Dermot, Belfast?
Yeah, I was born in 1956, so the Troubles, it was about,
10 years old.
Yeah, when it all, the carry-on started out. It was crazy time. Like it was, you used to get evacuated because we thought the Fenians were coming down the Old Lodge Road. And there was all this fear, and next thing you'd be up in your sister's house, up in the mountains, at Cave Hill, looking down at Belfast, burning and everything. Mm-hmm. And then you'd be listening to the police radios and all to see where it was. And it was absolutely crazy. There's gun battles going on everywhere. And then you'd find out that your street hadn't been invaded, so you'd return.
The fact that you talk about the Fenians, obviously you were from the Unionist tradition?
Loyalist, Shankill Road area, yeah.
And were you always brought up to talk about Catholics as Fenians?
No, not really. No. My people, there wasn't a sectarian bone in their body. At that time, my sister, Florence, I mean, all her friends were Catholics because she was a nurse in this Musgrave Park Hospital, and all her friends were all Catholics, and they would be around our house all the time. Jimmy loved them, every one of them, and they gave him a big roll-up picture of the Pope, whoever he was at the time, and that was in the top of the piano in the parlour. And I used to get annoyed about this Pope, not because he was the Pope, because that's where I had all my model airplanes. So I had to remove all my model airplanes to accommodate this Pope on the top of the piano. So our relationship with the nationalists was, my father was not a unionist in the big U notion of the word. Mm. He was always of a kind of, he always voted for the Northern Ireland Labour Party and what have you. And we never flew a flag, and he was never in the Orange Order. We were never brought up in sectarianism, but that isn't to create some little ideal. Sectarianism was always around you. The Troubles were flaring up, and I mean, you could not but not notice it. And when you went to primary school, 3/4 of that class in primary school all died as a result of the Troubles from one way or another. So it had a serious big impact, as indeed the whole Troubles did. And when you look back, it really, really did. But at the time, it's all part of some kind of mad absurdity. And you don't really know that you're living in an abnormal world. Mm. And it's only when you start to leave that you begin to sort of see that there's something wrong here. And those first little tentative steps take place when you go to third level education, which took me to art college, you know.
And yet you went to art college on the island of Ireland. An awful lot I have found of Unionists or Loyalists of your generation, they left.
That's very true. A few of us from that school went to art college in Belfast, and the idea of crossing over to Britain or England or anything like that never crossed our minds. None of us, I think, had ever never been there, you know. Mm. It was just like too far away.
And in fact, Belfast was the only place in Ireland that you could do a master's degree at the time in fine art as well. And that's why I went there. And that's why people from the south, you know, the new group, as Durban called them each time, went up to do their master's in Belfast, because there was no other college at that time where you could get a master's in fine art.
I'm so glad that I didn't leave, because I say if I had left, it probably wouldn't be where I am today.
Did your mum die when you were very, very young?
Yeah, well, you see, when I talk about my mother and father in the Shankill, I'm talking about my aunt and uncle who reared me, because my real mother was her sister, and she kind of died of a broken heart, whatever that means. So they reared me from when I was 9 months.
What do you mean your mum died of a broken heart?
Well, I think what they mean nowadays is probably took her own life, you know. But I was only 9 months old, so I was taken over by her sister, and they became my mother and father. So when I talk about my mother and father, I talk about the McKeown family.
She possibly, today people might say you're suffering from postnatal depression or something. It's probably different.
There was no title or word for
it. The word for it
was broken heart.
Were you conscious that your mum was dead, or did you grow up thinking for a long time your aunt was your mum?
I always was told that she had died all right, yeah. And that I had, but I don't know why. I just always called my aunt Mama. So the only difference with me and growing up, no, because I was only 9 months old, so it was just brought up with the whole McKeown family.
Well, they were your family.
Yeah, they were. They
would have been. And the only difference was I just had a different surname. That was all. My real father, he would come round once in a blue moon with loads of presents. And all the kids were very envious of this in the street, you know, the street kids and all, because they had two dads. And they would all, a lot of them wished that they had two dads so that they could get all these
presents.
Like double Christmases, you know.
Yeah. As you got older, have you thought back on your real mother at all?
Oh, you do all the time. She's always there. She's like sort of a thing on your shoulder because you never knew her and you often wonder about who she was. But my sisters have told me what she was like, particularly my elder sister who died a couple of years back. She knew her quite well and she described her as a very kind of glamorous person with red nails and red lips, and apparently looked very like me in the sense that she had brown eyes and dark hair and all, you know.
Do you have a photograph of her?
I do have a couple of photographs of her.
That's actually a very sad story.
It's not really, it's just a story of
it's
life.
It's just a story.
Do you know what I mean? Like, life is a series of stories.
It's, it's sad when you tell it, but I mean, it didn't affect me as a kid or anything. Not that I know of. I mean, I suppose somebody else could tell you probably.
Well, everybody has stories, you know, in their lives, so, you know.
It's a big blow, though, I always think, if you're a little kid and your mum dies. I think it's one of the biggest blows.
It's a blow if you're a big kid as well.
Yeah.
I mean, any time when you lose your parents, it's really, really...
I think when you're 9
time.
Months old, though, you don't know. So it's an abstract, you know. It's your first abstract outside of religion, you know.
In fact, it might even affect you more, you know, when you're a teenager or when you're older, when you understand what's happening.
You were lucky you had such a great aunt.
Oh, she was brilliant. Like, oh, they were great.
Yeah.
I mean, she
she was at the wedding.
Yeah.
She lived a great age. She was like 93.
And did she always encourage you going into art? Was she worried
at
all?
No, not in the fit. She was always, she hadn't a notion what art was or anything. She could never ever get her head around it. And right up to I was like in my 30s and 40s, she would cut out things from the press for jobs that I could maybe be interested in.
Like what?
Well, jobs in various civil service jobs. Or
can you imagine?
Clerk.
No, I cannot imagine him.
And whatever types of jobs would be advertised in them days in the press. Yeah. And she'd cut them out, and when I visited her, she'd hand them over to me, you know.
And I think my father thought I could be a guard or something, thought that would be the height of getting a great job, or maybe an air hostess. You know, when you were tall, people thought then you'd be an air hostess or a guard. And actually, when Mary Robinson was elected president, which he was totally against, actually, because he was a real dyed-in-the-wood kind of Fianna Fáil guy, and when she did such a great job, he really had to kind of acknowledge that. And I remember him turning to me and he said, "You could be president." You know, it was just like a revelation to him that a woman could actually be the president of the country and do a really, really great job.
When you both had your, say, first exhibitions or your first success, did that make your family, or for instance, in your case, Dermot, your mum, realise actually he can make a life of this?
No, that never happened.
Well,
I know in our sort of final few months, when she had broken her leg and couldn't move and she'd been put into an old people's place. And I think she said to my sister Florence, you know, is Dermot okay now? Is he meaning it, will he be all right?
Yeah.
Because she knew that she was probably going to die in the next few weeks.
Whereas actually my father revelled in, you know, having exhibitions and stuff, and he would come to them. And in fact, he met you at the big first show I had in the Douglas Hyde in Dublin, which was called Familiar, 1994. And Dermot was there, had the moustache still. But I met my father. They had a great night.
And that's a photograph we have of that. It's the first family photograph before I was a member of the family.
Yes, that's right. With me and my father and Dermot. Yeah. And but my mother had passed away already at that stage. But he met both of them, which is kind of great for me. And that was another reason to have the wedding in Tipperary. It was kind of be close to them, even though they were gone, you know, but it was a way of kind of having them at the wedding.
Well, mentioning Tipperary, that brings us nicely to our next piece of music, which is Adelia Murphy. Tell me about this song and why you're choosing it.
Well, I didn't choose it. No, that's Dermot's choice. When we moved to the studios in Mayo, he brought home this local singer, as he called her, Adelia Murphy, from Mayo. And, you know, we'd be having a really nice party dinner or something and everybody'd be eating and having a great time. The next thing is Dermot would shout out, Adelia, and he'd bring out Adelia Murphy and we'd have to listen to this kind of camaraderie music.
Well, it's actually brilliant music. I really think it's fabulous.
But actually, when I listened to the music, I knew all the words because my own mother used to sing those kind of songs to us. And she was always singing, actually. It just came back to me that she was always singing.
Yeah.
And Dermot was really surprised that I knew all the words of those songs.
My mother's generation would have been... She knew Adelia Murphy, Bridie Gallagher, Margaret Barry. That was the music of the time, Brent, no doubt. So that's what you grew up with.
Yeah.
Even in the Shankill Road, that's what people listen to.
And that's what I was listening to as a child, which is amazing. And the other different end of the country altogether. They're the songs that my mother was singing to me.
And why do you still like Delia Dermot?
It's the way people like John McCormick. It's the crackliness of the time. It's like a period long gone, which you were part of and it's no longer around you.
Yeah.
So it's a kind of weird, ghostly nostalgia that...
It's the other...
The melancholia that just...
Is it true you put it on to drive your guests mad at parties sometimes?
Oh, well, the young ones hate it.
Yeah. And the old ones hate it.
But they will come to like it when they're our age.
Let's listen now to Delia Murphy with Leaving Tipperary. Delia Murphy there with Leaving Tipperary. You really love that, don't you, Alice?
Yes.
You both work in Mayo, in your home, but you've two studios, is that right?
Yeah. Well, we designed our place around our own work, practices how we work, both of us, and we're completely different, obviously. So Dermot designed his own space around how he works, and I designed my place around how I work.
Okay, tell me yours then.
Well, mine's a very, very big space, you know, with lots of light getting into it. So it's full up of stuff, you know, collected from this, that and the other thing, and part of a set that I'd used in a piece that I did with Trevor Knight. And then there's the whole area is painted black, you know, where I filmed. And then there's a computer over there and there's boxes of berries. And, you know, it's full up of stuff. Whereas I guess Dermot's is much more kind of organised and it's strictly for painting kind of thing. Mine is much more kind of a mixed media kind of thing. And then we have the separate living space, which is separate from the studios completely. And that's where we kind of come together.
And describe your studio, Dermot.
Well, Alice's studio is like an aircraft hangar. My studio is big as well, but I just don't quite need an aircraft hangar. But yeah, I've always worked in very small spaces, even though I've done quite large work. I used to do giant paintings in Donnybrook Street in Belfast, which I never ever seen until they were in a gallery and I could actually stand back and see what I'd actually done. So I still have that habit of creeping up in the corner of a studio and just sitting there and working. Yeah. And then now I'm able to walk away back and have a look at what I did. But I don't really take up a lot of room, you know, I don't. So,
well, I wouldn't have had much space either. As I went down over the years, I would have worked in rooms and domestic spaces, but this was my chance, you know, to get my space that I really wanted. So I just went for as much space as I possibly could.
And could you have shared a studio?
No.
That's a definite no.
No way. No. Not
why? I mean, just impossible.
You just couldn't work with somebody else. You know, it's a completely private, individual, you know, process of thinking and reading and walking around and looking. And there's just no way you could do
it. But you're even in group studios as such. They're all sealed off from each other. No artist can work with another artist in the same territory. You know, you just couldn't.
Do you have a routine, both of you? Like, do you work every day?
Yeah, I don't think you ever stop working, actually, even when you're not working, because you're thinking and reading. Yeah. And, you know, everything, for me, everything gets into my work, everything that's happening around. So I'm like a type of a sponge or a sieve, if you think of it, going the other way. So all, you know, what's going on the radio, what I'm reading, what he's doing, whatever, that's all kind of getting in there, you know, in order to kind of make the works.
Do you listen to music, both of you, when you work?
Well, I would.
I don't. I have to have complete silence. Yeah.
If I'm working in the evenings, I would listen to music, but during the day, I would just listen to the radio, you know.
Yeah, but sometimes Dermot would be over in his studio for hours and hours, and I could hear the music, you know, coming out of there, and I don't know what he's doing. I think he might be just sitting there thinking or looking, or, whereas I cannot concentrate.
Do you go into each other's studios a lot?
No. No.
Not really, just to pass through, you know.
To ask something or
whatever.
Yeah. But, I'd knock. I mean, I wouldn't just walk in.
Would you knock?
No.
She doesn't need to knock. It's just her habit. Yeah. I never asked her to knock. She's just more than welcome. She can come in wherever she wants. She doesn't have to knock.
But do you knock going into hers?
No, I just walk through. Well, hers place is so big. Sure, what's the
point?
You wouldn't
even hear.
But that is me. I wouldn't say I work hard. I just work consistently.
Yeah.
And there's a difference because art isn't a kind of a 9-to-5 labour.
No.
It's not mining or anything like that there.
But I'd say I work hard too. I mean, I put a lot of labour actually into what I do, because a lot of the stuff takes, you know, a lot of actual physical labour, maybe, you know, time to do it. So I do put in the work in that sense as well.
But like, you sit down to have dinner, I assume, do you, in the evening together?
Yeah.
And do you discuss what you've done that day?
No,
not in a fit, because the thing is, I mightn't have done anything that day. So it's not a 9-to-5
and
world.
And who would
want
to put it out there anyway? Who would want to put it out there and ruin it, you know?
But you tell each other what you're working on?
Vaguely.
Well, Alice would be much more.
I'd be much more looking for, you know,
advice,
looking for advice.
Yeah.
So I'd say to Dermot, I was thinking of doing this or something, you know, what would you say? And, you know, his advice is always the same.
Which is?
Beetle your champ. Which is a Belfast saying for
just what does
keep
that
going.
Mean?
Is it?
Keep at it.
Just keep at it.
Keep
it's
going.
The best advice I ever got. So
beetle your champ.
Just do it.
Yeah, must remember it.
Just get on with it.
Just keep going.
Just keep going.
Yeah.
And that's the way art is made, in a way, by just keeping going. You know, you just go from one thing to another. Like, people often ask me, you know, what was your inspiration or some word like that, you know, for that work. But I always say it was just the work that went before it. Because one thing leads to another in, you know, in concept, in ideas and in actual making. So that's the way art is made. One thing leads to another. It's not just, boom, you get a big idea and you're going to make something out of snails. You know, it's a whole continuum of when you actually started work in 1982 until now. And people sometimes ask me in a lecture or something, how long did it take you to make that? And I always say 30 years.
That's a good question.
Good answer, actually. Knowing I was interviewing you today, I just went to see your retrospective in Earlsford Terrace, which you met me there.
I thought you were a teacher. Yeah. There was a whole bunch of students in the lecture theatre piece called L'Université with all the little lights shining on the graffiti, and they were all there, you know, studiously reading the looking at the drawings. And I saw this woman coming out. That was you. I thought it was their teacher, and I said, "That's great. They're reading."
I know. Yeah. It was lovely. The ice, for instance, that amazing piece of art. Where did that idea come from?
It's called Mnemosyne. She was a goddess, the goddess of memory. I suppose it's around the theme of memory and how to remember, and, you know, the way people remember things completely differently.
Yeah.
And so it's really about the notion of trying to freeze memory. But that piece, I made it in conjunction with an engineer called Tom O'Dowd, and he normally makes pieces for the display of fish, you know, for fish display or for shops and supermarkets. So this was the first time he ever got to make something that was totally non-functional, and he was totally into it. And we made a great team, you know, together to make this piece that was non-functional but conceptual in the way it was going to be shown. And the thing is that it uses the air to make itself, you know, it makes itself. It's, if you could describe it simply, it's like a fridge turned inside out. So the mechanism is on the outside, so it attracts the moisture in the air to itself, and it makes frost on its surface. So it gets thicker and thicker, depending on how long it's turned on. So in a way, you could compare it to memory in that way, in that it's using the memory in that room. If you think of that space, Earlsford Terrace, which was a university for years and years, and all the different people that passed through it. So it's using the atmosphere there to make itself, and then it just melts, and that memory is gone, and a new one has to recreate itself the next day.
Yeah. Do you have a favourite piece of Alice's, or is that an impossible?
Well, they're all great. I mean, I'm so intimate with them all.
Yeah.
Yeah. The one I haven't seen, because see, all her work, I've seen it in its process and her making of it. But that particular piece of the lights on the desks, I had no notion of that. I'd never seen anything to do with that because it was done.
I don't think I even told you about it. I was making that. Surely.
Well, you did, but I didn't know what you were talking about because you didn't have any, there was no reference for me anywhere or anything.
Yeah.
So, because it was done in situ, I had absolutely no idea. Like, and she had talked about these things with lights and desks and things, but sure, if you don't have a notion, whereas before that, I had loads of notions because it was there in front of me and I'd seen the whole process.
But it's a very, very simple.
For the listeners who don't
piece.
Know what it is, tell them about it.
Well, there's a beautiful lecture theatre in Earlsford Terrace, and it's one of the older lecture theatres, so all the desks are wooden, you know, very hard wooden desks. So people had sat at those desks for years and years and years, right from the time, I don't know, James Joyce before, I don't know. And so they had written, some people would have scratched into the desks, you know, their names or dates or and sayings and something that occurred to them or drawings. Mm. So I just thought this is really interesting way to kind of capture memory or atmosphere or, you know.
One of them is I Miss Her, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, the girls, actually, the schoolgirls were
Did
talking
they think
about
that.
That.
Yeah. Yeah, that was very poignant to me because somebody had written for one date, I miss her. And then months later, there was another date, I still miss her. Yeah. So you're like capturing people's emotional lives, you know, from years and years ago, while they were listening supposedly to a lecture, you know, the main thing that was going on, what was going on in their own mind was completely different. You know, their mind was wandering into their emotional life, you know, or into their subconscious life.
And earlier Alice there was talking about fish and actually fish.
But just before you go there, because you did ask me, which is my favourite piece.
Oh, yes.
And I think because I had never seen this in its process, and when I did go and see it on the night of her opening, I went, wow, this was just amazing. So to answer your question, I think that is a most amazing piece because I had no reference before of it. So it really blew my mind. It what it did to me was like seeing a piece of Alice's work the way an outsider who had seen it for the first time.
Yeah.
So that was a treasure, yeah.
In terms of Dermot's work, what's your favourite piece of his painting?
God, I don't think I could pick out a favourite piece of Dermot's, actually. That would be very, very difficult for me because I see it all as a kind of continuum of change and all the different influences from the places he has been and the views he has had by just looking out his window. I can kind of trace them back, you know, through Mayo, through Monaghan and places, you know, that he's lived. I can see the different landscapes, through those. So it would be very difficult for me to pick out a particular painting, although I do like that one that's called On the Balcony of the Nation, where there's this kind of cow falling over a cliff. Well, she looks like she's about to be unbalanced and fall over a cliff.
Yeah. Interesting, you were brought up in the city, in Belfast, but there's a lot of rural life in your work.
Yeah, well, we're only one generation removed from the countryside. Belfast, particularly then, you know, at the end of every street was the fields, you know, so...
Yeah.
The mountains of West Belfast, the Black Mountain, Divis and Cave Hill and all, they were right at your back door. So in lots of streets you had families who did outdoor pursuits, like shooting and fishing and everything. And so some twist of fate, they ended up hanging around with the Brennan family. And the Brennans are great anglers and hunters and all that sort of stuff. So I hung around with their kids. Next thing, I was sucked into their whole thing and was learning the fly fishing and doing all the fishing carry on and... next year, half the time you're in the country going fishing and walking the hills.
Well, when you're not painting, you're fishing.
Stuff.
When you're not fishing, you're painting.
Yeah. So I carry that to this very day. Yeah.
And can you not stand back now, look at that retrospective and relax and think, wow, I've done a great body of work there?
I'd say not.
Yeah,
No.
No, but I must say that I'm happy with it and with the way it worked in that building. It was a fantastic opportunity to work there in that particular building with Sean Cassan, the curator, you know, to do something for Emma off the Emma site, you know, and in the middle of the town. And I think it has a lot more, you know, audience and people coming to it actually, you know, because of where it is. And that's brilliant for me.
Yeah, Neresford Terrace there,
yeah.
Do you feel very lucky as we come to the end that you both work at what you both wanted to be? That in fact you've managed to end up in your lives making a living and doing on a daily basis what you both love, which is art.
Oh, there's absolutely no doubt about that. I'm glad when I look around me and see the way people have to...
Yeah.
Now, we've never made much money at it, really, and we're not certainly not wealthy, but we've did okay.
Yeah.
And other friends my age are like have done... They're loads better off than I am, but sure, they're...
I feel
like direct. They're soulless, with no disrespect to them, but they just work too hard. You know what I mean? In a slave sense, rather than sort of work at what I feel I do, you know?
Mm.
And of course, everybody can't do what I do, but no more than I can do things that everybody else does, you know? But everyone to their own, you know? So
would you do something you both love?
Yeah, like I wouldn't call it love now.
No?
You know
what
I mean? That's what everybody says, that you must be wonderful doing something you love, but actually sometimes you actually hate it, you know, because it's so hard, you know, it's very hard to bring something to fruition and to make something that's worth, you know, showing to an audience. So it's not that full of satisfaction that people go on about all the time. No. It must be great satisfaction, you know, making art. It's not actually, it's just a whole load of dissatisfaction.
It is.
Certainly
for me. Does it make it easier or harder then to live with an artist?
It makes it easier to live with an artist, I think, because another artist, for me anyway, totally understands that that's what comes first, that your art comes first in everything.
Above your relationship?
Well, I wouldn't push any, we would
respect that if it seemed to do so and it wouldn't be a threat. Whereas if you weren't, if your partner or wife or whatever or wasn't, they might get jealous because you're putting all your time into that.
Yeah.
Whereas I fully understand and vice versa.
Yeah.
Therefore, that is never a problem.
No.
You know.
I'm so glad for both of you that you did meet each other again in your 40s and ended up together. But look, we're going to end on another piece of music. Whose choice is this one?
I think we chose that together. Is that Lola Beltran?
Yeah. Oh, of course, yes,
from
definitely.
Mexico.
Oh, yeah, Mexico.
We went to Mexico after we got married. Dermot had a great friend called Alfonso Monreal. He's a Mexican artist who lived in Ireland. He'd married an Irish woman. And he said we could have his house in Zacatecas, which is a beautiful silver city up in the Sierra Madre. It's the west of Mexico. So we went there and we had such a great time.
Yeah.
What a great country. We really
had a mad time.
We met the maddest of people and we didn't even know that we were in danger or any such thing.
That's right. Yeah.
But the music of the country really, really struck us. And we were staying in this hotel in
Mexico City,
wasn't it? And what was it called?
Isabella Católica.
Isabella Católica was the name of the... And they had a cantina on the ground floor and we used to go there every night. And this fantastic street singer came in every night and she sang. You'd give her a few pesetas and she sang. But she was like the kind of Edith Piaf of Mexico, you know, this beautiful street singer. And Dermot said, ask her what her favourite music is. So I asked her because I had a little bit of Spanish and she said Lola Beltran. And so we went immediately and bought the Lola Beltran and we've been listening to her ever since.
Yeah.
Alice Maher and Dermot Seymour, thank you both very much for being my guests. Your exhibition, Alice, is called Becoming and it's continuing at IMA on Earlsford Terrace here in Dublin until February the 17th. It's open to the public from Tuesday to Sunday and full details can be found at IMA.ie. Thanks on sound today to Barry Kavanagh, to my producer Eileen Herron. I'll be with you at the same time next week. Here's Lola Beltran.
Me caí de la nube en que andaba como a 20,000 metros de altura. Por poquito que pierdo la vida, esa fue mi mejor aventura.
Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1. Listen back or podcast at rte.ie/radioplayer.